This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and Broadcasting and Cable Magazine, sitting in for Terry Gross. Easter is coming up, celebrating the resurrection of Jesus Christ after his crucifixion. We're going to take a historical look at crucifixion, which was a widespread form of punishment in antiquity. Our guest, John Dominic Crossan, is Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University and author of the books The Birth of Christianity, Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography, and Who Killed Jesus? Crossan describes his work as combining faith and history. He's a former Roman Catholic monk and the former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, which investigates ancient historical evidence to help understand the life and times of Jesus. The seminar is controversial, in part because it does not take the Gospels literally and uses history to reconcile the different versions of Jesus' story as told in the four Gospels of the New Testament. Terry Gross spoke with John Dominic Crossan in 2004. He said crucifixion was practiced as a form of state terrorism for centuries before it became infamous under the Romans.
Now, who were some of the people that were typically punished with crucifixion?
In general, especially in the Roman situation, you can say almost definitely it was almost synonymous with the slaves' execution. It was a warning to other slaves not to flee, not to commit a crime, not, of course, to kill their master or mistress. And it was extremely public. Its point was not so much the amount of suffering, though, of course, it was a horrible suffering, but it was a public warning. You were literally hung up like a poster. Don't do what this person did, or you'll end up as this person did. So very much for the lower classes and especially for slaves.
Now, you say that during Roman times, crucifixion was one of three primary ways of capital punishment. There was crucifixion, being burned alive, and getting fed to the lions.
The Romans talked about suprema supplicia, supreme penalties, and they really didn't calculate them in terms of the amount of suffering. They really calculated them in terms of annihilation. So being crucified, being fed to the beasts, as it were, are being burned alive, the function was there would be nothing left to bury. So even when they were finished with your corpse, the relatives, the loved ones, would have nothing to bury. There'd be no tomb where they could mourn, where they could come to grieve, where they could even, say, eat with the beloved dead. They wished to annihilate you and to do it publicly.
Even with crucifixion?
The theory behind crucifixion actually was that you would be left on the cross until you were consumed by wild beasts or wild animals. Now, we know, for example, that there was one case in the first century because we have found the heel bone of a crucified person with the nail still in place, and this person was buried, honorably buried. So it is possible, of course. It depends upon whether maybe you could bribe the guards or have enough influence to get the body given to you. Then you could get the body back. But in theory, the purpose of crucifixion was to leave the body there until there was nothing left.
Was scourging or whipping usually the first step before crucifixion?
In general, scourging preceded crucifixion, and the function of scourging was to reduce resistance. They did not want a person, for example, staggering through the streets with a crossbar, cursing Rome or fighting them all the way. What you wanted, this was public spectacle, what you wanted was somebody reduced to the state that the most it could do was stagger, as it were, to crucifixion, unresisting. So yes, usually scourging would have preceded crucifixion.
How does Jesus' crucifixion, as described in the Gospels, compare with what is known historically about the procedures of crucifixion?
In general, the crucifixion itself, and in a way the Gospel has only one word, they crucified him. They don't describe the details that would show up, for example, in a play or a film. You don't have to decide if you're reading the Gospel, does Jesus carry only the crossbar or does he pull a huge cross and upright already in position? It simply says it crucified him. Another thing it does tell you is that the crime, as it were, the claim, the alleged claim of being king of the Jews was the sign given that you'd always have in a crucifixion, saying this is what this person did. So the crime is, as it were, hung around his neck or attached to the cross in some way. But everything that's said about the crucifixion of Jesus would fit quite well into what you'd expect in the first century crucifixion.
And it said he was scourged, and it said he was mocked.
The mocking is probably a separate issue, and in one sense, the mocking is terribly ironic because he's been mocked as a pseudo-king, and of course any reader of the Christian New Testament, the Christian Gospel, believes profoundly that he was a king, far more than Caesar was or Pilate as a local governor, that their mocking was profoundest truth. So the mock, in a way, the Gospel spends far more time, if you count the verses, I think there's about four verses on the mocking, and there's only one single word in Greek for the scourging. They wanted to describe the mocking because of the tremendous irony that the soldiers mocked him as a king. I have no idea whether that is historical or not. They certainly could have, but the point of insisting on it is the irony that he was being mocked as a king, and of course, we Christians who are reading this gospel believe him most profoundly to be king, not just of the Jews, but of the world.
When did the cross become a symbol of Christianity?
Very, 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 very slowly and cautiously. In the time before Constantine, that is, before the beginning of the 4th century, when Christianity became more or less the official religion of the Roman Empire, you have very, very many mentions, of course, from Paul's letters on of the cross, of the crucifixion. But you don't see pictures of it. The very earliest one we have, actually, of the crucifixion is, again, we're back to the mocking. A page in the Palatine Palace in Rome was mocking a fellow page who apparently was a Christian. His name was Alexandros. So the page scratched on the wall of their dormitory, as it were, a model of the crucifixion in which Jesus is portrayed with the head of a donkey. And written underneath it is, Alexander worships his God. And probably that's the only way it would have been shown as a mocking of the crucifixion until after the victory of Constantine.
Have you thought about if so many people were crucified, if it was such a common form of execution, why did that become the symbol for Jesus Christ?
The crucifix only became, or the cross only became the symbol for Jesus always as accompanied by the resurrection. I mean, this is two things, execution, resurrection, mm-hmm. death, resurrection, always the two things. Because, of course, the point is that Jesus was officially, legally, publicly executed by Rome. It wasn't that Pilate made a mistake or that Pilate simply was rounding up people and he grabbed Jesus by mistake. Jesus was executed by the normalcy of the civilization of his day. Then, of course, when you say that God raised Jesus from the dead, you've got two things on a collision course. Rome crucified Jesus. God raised Jesus. Then the inference is very clear. This God we're talking about is on a collision course with Rome, because God had, as it were, countermanded the official decree of Rome. And so if you take away the resurrection, then the crucifixion becomes almost meaningless, or you have to get into another theology in which the crucifixion is the center of Christianity all by itself.
When you, as someone who studies the historical Jesus, think about the resurrection, do you think about it as metaphor or as actuality?
I think of it, I would not make the distinction of metaphor or actuality. I would make the distinction of metaphor or literal, because metaphors can be very actual. For example, the metaphor for me is that to claim resurrection for Jesus, and I can leave it completely, whether you take it metaphorically or literally, either way, what you are claiming is that something has happened here which is going to change the way the world sees everything. And I think that is right, because the claim you're making is that God has reversed the normalcy of civilization. And that's why it's very important for me to insist that Pilate, from his point of view, got it right. He looked at Jesus. He said, this person resists our law and order, as it were, not a violent resistor, or I'd have rounded up all his followers like I rounded up Barabbas's. But yes, he resists us, and therefore he must be publicly executed. Now, to say that God has reversed that decision puts God on a collision course with the normalcy of civilization. That, I believe, is actual, because I believe in what happened at the death of Jesus is that we were confronted with a warning that violence is going to destroy us. We got a warning that if you do not resist evil nonviolently, violence will destroy us. I think something did happen, because that was a warning, and we have not been heeding it for 2,000 years.
With the resurrection, do you think that there was some kind of physical transformation that happened to the actual body of Jesus?
No, I don't. I am completely convinced that Jesus had told people before his death that the kingdom of God has already arrived and that we have begun to participate with God in what I'm going to call the great cleanup. The fancy word for that is eschatological consummation. The great cleanup of the world, the attempt to make it a just place. I am absolutely certain also, historically I'm speaking, that people had visions of Jesus after his execution. They had visions, they are not hallucinations. They are visions, they are apparitions of Jesus. When they put those two things together, they said, then Jesus has risen as the beginning of the general resurrection. That's the only thing the word could have meant to them. It's not a personal, private privilege for Jesus. He has risen as the head of those who have died before him and as the promise of those who will die after him. I take that metaphorically. I do not take it actually. I do not think all around Jerusalem on Easter Sunday morning there were hundreds of empty tombs. And I don't think the people who believed in the harrowing of hell ever suggested, let's go out and check the tombs of the prophets to see if they're gone. I think they knew quite well what they were saying. They were saying something which they took metaphorically and which we take literally. And I think we've kind of lost the actuality.
I know that you've seen Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, and I'm wondering if you could give us your short review of how the Jesus story is told in the movie.
Basically, there's a couple of things that any passion story or passion drama does. You take the four Gospels, and there are four of them, by the way, and you reduce them to one. And then you reduce that one Gospel to simply execution. And then you reduce that execution to passio, the Latin word for passion, meaning suffering. So everything coalesces on the suffering of Jesus. Therefore, for example, there is nothing in Mel Gibson's movie, except brief flashbacks, more to increase the poignancy, about the life of Jesus. So by the time you come to the execution, and the resurrection, of course, is even more fleeting in this movie, you have no idea why anyone at all, would want this person dead, let alone executed publicly. You don't even understand it. Nor do you understand why, for example, it begins with a nighttime arrest of Jesus accompanied by Judas, who betrays him. Why was that necessary? Couldn't the authorities have grabbed him any time they wanted? Well, if you've been reading the story from Palm Sunday on, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, as we would say, of that week, the crowd is all on the side of Jesus. It's said again and again and again in the gospel. The high priestly authorities are afraid to move because the crowd are on the side of Jesus. And in Mark 14, 1 to 2, they give up. They finally say, well, we can't do it during the festival. There'll be a riot. Then comes Judas. And Judas says, I can arrange it. I can arrange that you'll get him apart from the crowd at night. So what is not in this movie at all is that the whole Jewish crowd in Jerusalem is so much on the side of Jesus that it requires this nighttime arrest and an apostolic traitor to get him.
When did passion plays become popular? When did it become popular to focus stories on the suffering, the crucifixion and suffering of Christ?
The emphasis on the suffering of Christ, almost the exclusion of everything else, is really a very much a medieval idea and may well reflect the experiences of people. If people are suffering, and I mean seriously suffering, say with plague or something like that or invasion, then to think of the sufferings of Jesus is extremely consoling. And the script that Mel Gibson used from The Dolorous Passion of Our Lord Jesus Christ, according to the Meditations of Anne Catherine Emmerich, is a good example. She had a life of suffering. She had a life of hardship, an Augustinian nun who spent the last 10 years of her life bedridden in great pain. And no wonder, of course, that she had an almost mystical union with the sufferings of Jesus, because she herself was in intense suffering. So the emphasis on suffering is, how shall I say it, appropriate maybe even necessary for people in intolerable pain. Outside that, it becomes dangerously close to pathological.
What do you mean by pathological?
I mean, when you start to focus on suffering and the whole meaning of, say, Jesus' life being reduced, and that verb is carefully chosen, reduced to suffering, it is not the way anyone thought about it in the first century. The Romans did not compute suffering. They didn't say we have to make this person suffer as much as possible, or they would have kept him in the barracks and tortured him for weeks on end. Their purpose was not suffering, but public warning. So when you bring it all down to suffering, it's very hard to show it without sadism.
Now, something that I find a little confusing, when we were talking a little earlier about crucifixion, you were explaining that for most Roman crucifixions, the dead body was left on the cross to be eaten by the birds of prey and by the wild dogs. And part of that was punishment for the family. The family would not be given the remains to be buried. There'd be no tomb, there'd be no remains. But the remains of Jesus is such a fundamental part of the Christ story. Do you think an exception was made for him, that there were remains, that there was a body?
It's utterly possible, because of the Philo, for example, does mention the possibility of a body being given back to the family. And in a way, it's not so much a punishment for the family as a punishment for the person, because they're being annihilated. And we have the crucified heel bone of somebody who was honorably buried. So it is utterly possible that in an exceptional cases, either because you bribed the guards or because you were able to get some influence, it was utterly possible to get the body and give the body normal burial. Now, the problem is that the Jewish law of Deuteronomy says by nightfall the body must be off the cross. I have no evidence, and that's, I would say, I expect that the Romans did not follow Jewish law, because the purpose of crucifixion was to let you die in agony on the cross. And if the person, let's imagine a case in which the person was only crucified by late in the afternoon, they would not be taken down from the cross. So the question is, and this is the question, is the story of Joseph of Arimathea in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or of Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus in John, is that an historical record of what happened? Or that is that Christians' best hope of what they hope might have happened without knowing what happened to the body of Jesus?
So you think that the Gospels might be more about that hope than the reality, more about hope than journalism?
Here is the problem. When you look at Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, the story of the burial of Jesus, knowing that Mark is the basis for Matthew and Luke, and that possibly, this is debated in scholarship, they may be the source for John. You watch the body's burial get steadily better. It's a hasty, hurried burial in Mark. By the time Matthew and Luke read Mark and develop the story, it's burial in a tomb in which nobody else has been laid, and they're explaining to you why Joseph of Arimathea was able to be a counselor for Jesus, but not against him on Thursday night, as it were. The story is developing, and by the time you get to John's account, the burial of Jesus is, I wouldn't even say royal, it's transcendental. There is so much spices used that they would fill almost the entire tomb. It's a magnificent burial. It's the burial of the Son of God when you get to John. Now, what happens is, as a historian, when I retroject that trajectory of a burial getting better and better and better, and I ask what was there in the beginning, it doesn't look very good. It looks to me like all they might have had at the very beginning is a hope that maybe some pious, non-Christian Jew, out of respect for the law of Deuteronomy, would have buried Jesus' body. But that immediately then raises the issue that they see. Well, wouldn't he also have buried the two robbers who were crucified with Jesus? And wouldn't there be at least three in the tomb? And would it be a public tomb for criminals? And then how would we know which was Jesus's body? And so you can see them, I think, grappling with the difficulties of a story which I don't think is historical. I think it is their fervent hope, their best hope, that somebody took care of the body of Jesus. But none of that, by the way, in any way, is for or against resurrection, because resurrection is a new creation by God.
John Dominic Crossan, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure as always, Terry.
John Dominic Crossan, Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University and former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar. He spoke with Terry Gross in 2004. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.